The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Democrats push a bait and switch on infrastructure.
He's just the irresponsible, disrespectful, and definitely craters the deal from my perspective.
We'll look at the unacceptable details.
When you place the socialist in charge of the budget, which is what the Senate Democrats have done by having Bernie Sanders in charge of the budget committee, you're going to get socialist-type policies.
Later, why Americans are troubled by an unpatriotic Olympic athlete.
If you hate this country, don't represent it in Tokyo.
And how this is a product of the far left.
It seems like patriotism to them means tearing down your country.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. And follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. Great to be with you on this 4th of July weekend. A little over a week ago, President Joe Biden let slip the Democrats' true plans with the so-called infrastructure bill. He threatened to veto this slimmed-down bipartisan effort unless Congress also passed the enormously expensive progressive dream called reconciliation bill. All that work to create a bill for infrastructure that both sides can endorse was blown up in a single moment by the president. Earlier this week, I spoke with South Carolina Senator Tim Scott on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Do you feel double-crossed by President Biden threatening to veto the infrastructure compromise unless he got a reconciliation bill at the same time?
Well, there's no doubt about it. Anytime you think you have a deal, even though I may have voted against that deal, to have something added to that is just the irresponsible, disrespectful, and definitely craters the deal from my perspective.
The 10 members who they were counting on, I know Lindsey Graham has said it cratered the deal. Have the other ones, like Senator Collins, Senator Romney, for I have enormous respect for those two, have they talked to you yet about absolutely being bewildered and done with a sham process?
We have not had a conversation at all, so I won't say what their positions are, but my position is pretty clear that you cannot have some caveat that spends $3 trillion, eliminates the right-to-work laws in my state and 26 other states, and call that the precursor or the prerequisite for getting actual infrastructure taken care of. It's wrong, it's bad, and it's out of step with reality.
Now, my understanding is the original deal was we will pass infrastructure in the Senate, see if it passes the House. If it does, go to a conference committee, agree, negotiate, send it to the president. And when that's all done, then you can try reconciliation, but not before. Was that your understanding?
Well, my understanding is that you can't trust what the president says on infrastructure. That's my simple answer. And when that is the case, nothing else quite matters. The bottom line is a simple one, though, Hugh. If you're looking at a path to reconciliation, that's something that Joe Manchin and Senator Sinema will have to stop from happening. What we can do is focus on those priorities that the American people have around infrastructure. Any deal that requires us to do bad policy or make bad policy decisions to get to the good ones is bad overall.
Well, I know that, but what's happened in the media, the narrative, the media cover for the Democrat double cross, is they're out there saying, oh, the Republicans always knew there would be a reconciliation. And I keep saying, no, no, no. The Republicans knew that they were going to pass infrastructure. Then you would try to pass reconciliation, but they knew it wouldn't pass. They were never joined at the hip. Am I right?
You are 100% right. It's without any question. This is how we see these socialist ideas start being socialized in their public forum. It is wrong. It is not consistent with any deal that was ever on the table, as far as I know. And we had this conversation amongst the Republican senators. This was a non-starter for everyone that was in the room.
And I believe that members of your caucus who I talked to were counting on Manchin, Sinema, Hassan, and a few others to sink the reconciliation deal, and that this was a way to jump over that opposition by linking the two. Am I right again?
Don't know the answer to that question, to be honest with you, Hugh. I would say that there's no doubt that there's been a bipartisan coalition interested in reducing the infrastructure package. The question is, can the Democrats stand the heat in the kitchen? If they can, then they stand against their party. If they don't, they succumb to the pressure. I don't want reconciliation to be used on a $2 trillion mammoth package that has less to do with traditional infrastructure and more to do with a utopian society that can't exist because you can't perfect man and you can't expect people in Washington to spend your money better than you would.
The Biden blunder, a moment of candor, proved to be the moment of clarity for those who wondered if they can trust the Democratic leadership of Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. I invited Matthew Continetti, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, to join me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Now along comes bipartisan deal that lasts 2 hours, and then President Biden undoes it. Now, I've seen that misrepresented widely in mainstream media. What would you describe as the typical mainstream media reaction to the Republican position post the Biden default?
Sure. After Biden made that ridiculous comment last Thursday, the White House and the press kind of swung into action here, and they said, well, Republicans, everyone knew that the two bills were going to be tied together, that you couldn't have the bipartisan infrastructure deal without the $6 trillion reconciliation package that Bernie Sanders is prepping in the Senate Budget Committee. Everybody knew that. You know, why are Republicans being so upset? Republicans should recognize this is the way things were always going to be done. The truth is that did not work. That spin did not work, Hugh. And the evidence that the spin didn't work was Biden's, well, at least it came out under his name, statement late Saturday afternoon, that multi-paragraph statement basically tiptoeing away from the idea that if they don't pass the big reconciliation package, he would veto the bipartisan infrastructure deal.
Yep. Strike one was his initial reaction. Strike two was Nancy Pelosi saying that she agreed with Biden's initial reaction. Strike three was the walk back. So now we have to ask, where are we? Because it was clearly not what everyone understood. The media fell right in line, like Ben Rhodes's echo chamber was still there. All the instruments were tuned up and everyone began to play the same chorus. Republicans shouldn't be outraged. It's thaw outrage. It's made up. They have no reason to be upset. Now we're into phase four, which is clean up on aisle three. It's really not going to work because Republicans, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you. There are backwards. Shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. We're not going to be fooled twice. And is that a reasonable position to take, Matt, at this point?
Oh, I think it is for Republicans, to oppose everything and just say, look, this is a ridiculous agenda. Not only are you spending on things that aren't typically infrastructure, but you're also messing with the tax code and the 2017 tax reform, which most people, has benefited the economy. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And also some of the ways that Biden wants to mess with the tax code, including, as you've been pointing out again and again, Hugh, stepped up basis, which would really kind of revolutionize the way that we tax capital gains and estates in this country. That should just be opposed outright. But for the key senators who backed the bipartisan infrastructure deal, and I'm talking the Portmans, the Romneys, the Collinses, I think Biden's statement kept them in line for now. The real worry, and I think what's behind all of this, all of Biden's gaffe and all of the different spins that they've tried out over the course of the past few days, has been driven by Biden's continued appeasement of the left wing of his party. You know, when you place the socialist in charge of the budget, which is what the Senate Democrats have done by having Bernie Sanders in charge of the budget committee, you're going to get socialist-type policies, $6 trillion in this reconciliation plan he's planning, which includes, by the way, things that have nothing to do with taxes and spending, stuff like the PRO Act, which would nullify state right-to-work laws. About half the country have these right-to-work laws that allow you to join a job without having to join a union. Well, Comrade Sanders would get rid of that in this reconciliation package. Biden is worried that this new energized left is going to sink not only the bipartisan deal, but also any reconciliation package. And that's why he's he made his threat last week. And that's why they're really walking on tiptoes in the White House, worried that they'd either scare away the moderates or they'd anger AOC and Bernie Sanders and sink the package from the left.
Mike Rogers and Tim Scott said that this whole package is doomed, both the bipartisan compromise and any reconciliation. Nevertheless, if I were the Republicans, I want to float my idea past you, because normally if you put Romney, Collins and Portman together on a piece of legislation, they have triangulated Hugh Hewitt completely. I will go along with that. Those are my three policy preference Republicans. But I listen to the politics of Mitch McConnell. So to policy those three, whatever Mitch wants to do, I'm good with. If I were the leader, I'd go out and say, we will await the House version of the Republican-Biden compromise. When they pass that and send it over, if it's what we agreed to in the White House, we will pass that and send it to the president unchanged. If they don't send it to us, it will not pass. That puts all the weight on the Democrats to pass the compromise. I wouldn't take it up in the Senate. I would say to the House, send us, you know, Joe Biden knows what's in it. He had note takers in the room. We made a deal. Biden send that to Speaker Pelosi. If she passes it with Republican votes and sends it to the Senate, we will pass that. But it's got to come before reconciliation, because the assumption always was reconciliation stood no chance with Manchin, Sinema, Hassan and others, and that that would be the breakwater. And that's what the media won't report. What do you think of my timing and my suggestion, Matt?
That's an interesting scenario. I mean, I'm, as much as I might agree with it, I know that Pelosi would reject it outright. And then you'd be in a situation where the two chambers are in an absolute standoff. I think one reason the press continues to get this story wrong is they believe that somehow, they believe they're high on their own supply. They think that Joe Biden won this 1932 level landslide, this 1964 level Democratic landslide, and he's coming in there and he's the new heir of the New Deal and the Great Society, and he's operating with the huge 2-to-1 margins that the Democrats enjoyed in those two earlier periods. That's just not the case. As Biden has admitted, he has an effective 4-seat majority in the House. The Senate is tied, and that's created this bizarre situation where Bernie Sanders is tweeting out, you know, we need transformative change now, all capital letters, N-O-W. And you can't get anything done because the votes simply aren't there. So the one path they have, I really do believe, is somehow getting this bipartisan deal through with the 60-plus vote, having the House do it, and then appeasing not the left but Manchin, and getting him somewhere down to about $2.5 trillion. He said $2 trillion on Sunday with the rest of the package, and that passes on a party line vote. That's the best scenario for this White House, and it happens sometime, I think, in September.
Coming up.
It seems like patriotism to them means tearing down your country.
Congressman Dan Crenshaw addresses the Olympic athlete who turned her back on the United States flag when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The Summer Olympics begin in less than a month in Tokyo, Japan. Track and field hopefuls gathered in Eugene, Oregon in June to compete in the United States Olympic trial. The news of the athleticism took a backseat to one athlete who chose this moment to turn her back on the American flag after winning a bronze medal. Here's more from Salem host Mark Davis out of 6:60 a.m. The Answer in Dallas, Texas.
Young lady who's a hammer thrower, that Gwen Berry, and she finished third, and so got like bronze in the trials. The gold and silver finishers, hand over the heart, anthem is playing. Gwen Berry, hand on her hip, turns away from the flag. This is disgusting. This is contemptible. I mean, so what's her point? Well, she says, among other things, of course, George Floyd. I am really sorry George Floyd is dead. We as a country were all about solutions. We remain all about solutions. Chauvin just got 22 and a half years of good behavior. He'll get 15. Anyway, those George Floyd, George Floyd, George Floyd, George Floyd, George Floyd. The country really hated that day. We stood ready to do something about it, ready to unite, ready to look at solutions, ready to look at police procedure, ready to look at whether a crime was committed, ready to have just whatever. It was really hard to get to that conversation because America was on fire. Because the people who hate the police and hate America set fire to this country all over the place and rioted to beat the band. And we had to deal with all of that for the better part of a year. So a lot of people still carrying a whole lot of George Floyd grudges have decided, you know what, I think I kind of hate the country. Well, you know what, ma'am, if that's the case, don't wear our stinking uniform. Don't walk behind our stinking flag. Don't accept a medal from the Olympics in the process of representing our horrific, racist hellhole of a country. Stand up for what you believe. If you hate this country, don't represent it in Tokyo. Don't grace us with your hammer throwing if it is so distasteful to wear the uniform of this country, so impossible to honor this flag that chronicles and represents the freedoms you enjoy every day. Every day. I would respect her one molecule more if her hatred of America was so if she hates the country, don't represent it. She said, you know what? I hate this country's guts, its racist soul. I will not go to Tokyo and represent this country that I despise. I would disagree with all of her reasons for that, but I would acknowledge that at least she's putting her behavior where her mouth is. In a perfect world, the U.S. Olympic Committee should bar Gwen Berry from representing the United States. Because it should be an expectation that everyone who is going to wear the uniform of this country is going to adhere to some external expectations. The external expectation of a modicum of respect for the flag during the anthem ceremony.
The call to remove the athlete from the Olympic team came from a number of quarters and numerous political figures, including Texas Congressman Dan Crenshaw. He joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. You said Gwen Berry, who finished third, I believe, in the hammer throw and did not want to face the American flag when it went up at the trials, ought to be tossed off the Olympic team.
Look, I thought it was kind of funny how I became the face of this entire thing. I just answered what I thought was just a regular question on Fox and pointed out what I thought was pretty obvious. If you're going to represent the Team USA, you should, you should like the USA. And the mere notion of supporting the United States, that you shouldn't offend you. But if you're going to be on Team USA, after all. And I think a lot of people agree with that. But next thing I know, I was trending on Twitter. And it's funny these days what will trigger the left's meltdown. And it seems like patriotism to them means tearing down your country. I mean, it really has gotten to that. I don't think that's an overstatement. I don't think I'm throwing out red meat here. I think that seems to just be true. And Jen Psaki essentially said that, defending Gwen Berry. She said, I can't think of anything more patriotic than protesting against our country. And not something our country is doing, mind you. Just the country in general. It's like we love the country so much that we want to completely revolutionize and change it. That's sort of how the left feels about their country. It's like, could you imagine telling your wife that? I just love you so much. I just want everything about you to be different, though.
Yep.
I mean, would that be love or would that be some kind of sadistic sort of relationship?
Now, I know what they're going to do next. They're going to suggest that you are Joe McCarthy, reborn with an eye patch from Texas, and whatever the merits of your military record and your heroism, you're still Joe McCarthy, Tail Gunner Joe, because you want to give litmus test on patriotism to athletes, to which you will respond what, Dan Crenshaw?
Yeah, you know, and they also accuse me of, this is cancel culture, Dan. I thought you were against cancel culture, but aren't you doing cancel culture now? And I would say, no, look, this is a pretty reasonable discussion about standards of behavior. I mean, if an Astros player stepped onto the field wearing a Yankees outfit, there'd be a problem, right? They'd say, hey, you can't play. And again, so you're representing Team USA. You're not representing the Lakers. You're representing Team USA. So I think small standards of behavior, such as standing for the anthem, just according to the rules, are perfectly in line with expectations. And why isn't it cancel culture? And this is actually a really good topic to hit, because even I think conservatives get this wrong a lot too. I think everybody gets it wrong. So we got to define cancel culture properly. Cancel culture is bypassing normal debate by beating somebody over the head with some kind of accusation. Okay, so that's cancel culture, and it happens over something that is generally unintentional, maybe a bad joke, maybe a past comment that's taken out of context, maybe just a slip of the tongue, or over something that, you know, is traditionally okay, but is now not okay according to the woke left, right? And they desire to cancel you over it. So it's usually something that really shouldn't be that controversial that is controversial now. Now, why isn't this cancel culture? Because this person deliberately stepped into the fray. Like, she deliberately tried to make a skeptical of herself. You know, and of course claimed that it was an ambush, which I thought was just a hilarious explanation from Glenn Berry, that this anthem just unexpectedly played, like, which is, of course,
I didn't hear that. Did she really say that?
Yeah, that's 100% true. Yep. Claimed that it unexpectedly played, and she felt ambushed.
She's never watched an award ceremony before? Every Olympics, it's always the same. They play the anthem of the people standing on the platform. That is an expectation that is sort of built in to the process.
You'd be right. You'd be right. Everybody else seemed to be ready for it. You know, congratulations to our first and second place winners. Those two women, you know, deserved to win, and they were proud of their country.
To hear the rest of this conversation, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up, the former cop and current progressive pushes a conspiracy theory.
What officers, police departments, police chiefs, those who are savvy, try to do is pull back, make communities suffer just a little bit, so you'll miss that heavy-handedness.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Cries to defund the police have led many large Democrat-run cities to cut back on their police budgets. The results have been tragic, as violent crime has spiked in a dozen or so big cities. This week, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki floated the idea that Republicans are the ones who seek to defund the police. A laughable idea that didn't get far. But Psaki isn't the only Democrat working to push this problem onto the Republican Party. Democrats realize the public is growing weary and scared of the rising crime rates, and the 2022 elections are looming. Here's Salem host Larry Elder.
A former LAPD cop named Cheryl Dorsey, who appears frequently on MSNBC, she knows what's causing the crime surge. It's that the cops are cowardly and butthurt. Her terms, not mine. Again, former LAPD cop named Cheryl Dorsey.
We're talking about an uptick in crime. You just heard the rhetoric circa 1983 that's being, you know, repeated now. Cheryl, I am a little concerned because I know there are people in neighborhoods who have concerns about the violence they've seen. It's interesting that this is happening at the time of defund the police. We have to get to the root of the problem. Why do you think we're seeing an uptick in crime happening right now?
I think it's a combination.
This is the LAPD cop Cheryl Dorsey responding.
Of things, and we have to understand that police officers are the backbone. Patrol particularly are the backbone of any police department, and this reminds me of back in the day when I was on LAPD, when officers' feelings were hurt and they had the term blue flu, where officers openly talked about slow response to radio calls. You can break a police chief if response time is low, if you're not clearing crimes, if you're not responding to high priority calls, shootings in progress, murder, robbery. And so officers now we see across these 18,000 police departments are butthurt because, you know, they can't run willy-nilly through a police department and abuse with reckless abandon. So there's...
Wow. Wow. They're butthurt because they can't run through willy-nilly with reckless abandon. Wonder why she's a former LAPD cop.
So they're stepping away from specialized units, too cowardly to quit outright the department, but they're stepping away from units on the Columbus Police Department, the rapid response team, an entire platoon of SWAT officers walked away in Miami. And so I don't think it's a coincidence. And listen, bad guys know that cops aren't responding, that they're not coming out when they're capering. And so I think it's a combination of things.
What's your take?
Absolutely no concern at all for the systemic racism narrative that even Rahm Emanuel says is causing the police to, quote, go fetal, close quote, Democrat mayor. Cops are just not doing their job, she said, because their feelings are hurt. Not because they're worried about being falsely accused of racism. Not because they don't want to put themselves in a situation where some loudmouth activist who represents a minority of people in the community will not yell and scream about racism, possibly putting this officer at legal risk. No, nothing to do with that. They just had their feelings hurt, and so they're just not doing their jobs. Wow.
On, do you really think there is an uptick in crime the way that Republicans are framing it?
Do you really think there's an uptick in crime the way Republicans are framing it? I just read from you, Chicago Tribune. Shootings up year to year, Chicago. Homicides up year to year, Chicago. And the Chicago Tribune, by the way, endorsed Obama twice for president.
Necessarily think that there's an uptick in crime, and I can tell you that
I don't necessarily think there's an uptick in crime. Did she say that?
The way that Republicans are framing it.
I don't necessarily think that there's an uptick in crime, and I can tell you that I know firsthand, you know, statistics can be manipulated. And so I think that this is, again, what officers, police departments, police chiefs, those who are savvy try to do is pull back, make communities suffer just a little bit, so you'll miss that heavy-handedness, those overzealous cops who are abusing their authority in your communities. And then when you cry uncle.
Wow. This is unbelievable. Unbelievable. This is the former cop. They all collectively decided to pull back in Philadelphia, in St. Louis, in Newark, in Chicago, in New York, in Los Angeles, all of which have seen an increase in shootings and homicide. They all decided to pull back at the same time just because we want to let them know how necessary we are. And that's why we're doing that. We're going to let people die. We're going to let people get shot in order to make a point. Wow. Unbelievable.
I don't necessarily think that there's an uptick in crime, and I can tell you that I know firsthand, you know, statistics can be manipulated. And so I think that this is, again, what officers, police departments, police chiefs, those who are savvy try to do is pull back, make communities suffer just a little bit.
Those who are savvy, pull back.
So you'll miss that heavy-handedness, those overzealous cops who are abusing their authority in your communities. And then when you cry uncle, they come back times 10 with more militarization, more heavy-handed elephant hunters who are now preying on an unsuspecting public.
More heavy-handed elephant hunters? What does that even mean?
Coming up, a growing trend. Couples who don't want to become parents.
They speak of narcissism as a beautiful thing.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy.
I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Statistics reveal a population in decline in nearly every first world country. In many, there's a growing concern that an aging population will not have a sufficient workforce to support them. But the definition of family seems ever-changing. Children often aren't a part of the equation. What is happening? Here's my friend and colleague, Dennis Prager.
Child-free adults are just as happy as parents, study finds. Study finds is the modern human being's equivalent to Thus Saith the Lord. Experts say, study finds, Thus Saith the Lord, in that order. Laura Lavoie knew all of her life she didn't want to have children. Now 46, she never felt that draw, she said, part of a growing U.S. population opting out of parenthood. It's part of a larger trend of Americans having fewer children in general. The U.S. birth rate fell to a record low last year. And there could be 300,000 to 500,000 fewer births in 2021, according to some estimates. For Lavoie, there were many reasons to choose to be child-free. The most important is that I just don't want to raise children. It's just not something that has ever appealed to me. I don't want to be responsible for another human being in that way. You know what I love about this whole thing, and I will continue, is this couple's lack of self-consciousness. They speak of narcissism as a beautiful thing. There's no attempt to put it in moral terms. Lavoie, a writer who lives in Asheville, North Carolina, told Today, "But I also really like traveling. I like adventure. Never sitting in the same spot for very long and just kind of lifestyle things that don't really fit with having a child." Her husband feels the same way, she said. They've discussed it over the years, but knew the answer would always be the same, she noted. This goes under the heading of be safe. That's how I see it. The safe choice is not to have children. In fact, the safe choice is not to get married. The safe choice is to take few risks in life, live as much as possible for the moment, and that is what has become the dominant ethos of our time. You know, we are living in the age of the irrational. Never in American history has the irrational been so dominant as today. And that, too, is a consequence, ironically, for those who believe that secularism ushered in the age of reason. In other words, there's far more rational thinking among religious Americans than among irreligious Americans. I'm not talking about religious beliefs. Religious beliefs are not all fully in the realm of reason. That's true. That's why they're called faith. But when you apply it to society, there's no comparison that you will get far more rational responses to life from more religious people than non-religious people. Why have children? Why is this couple wrong? They want to travel more. They want to dine out more. They don't want to have to take care of somebody all the time, right? Why have a child? You have a secular answer? Well, there actually are a couple of secular answers that would apply whether you're religious or secular. How about this to begin with? Purpose of life is not to avoid difficulty. The purpose of life is not to play it safe. The purpose of life is not to have as much fun at any given moment as possible. since fun and happiness are not the same thing. There are actually more risks in having a child today than at any time in American history. Except the risks in the past were that they wouldn't live past childhood. That's true. Today, it's that they won't be a decent human being or think clearly because they went to school. It's a different risk today than in Abraham Lincoln's time. You want to grow up? That's the argument for marriage. I'd like to grow up. There is no human being that I know of, and probably that you don't know, who does not believe that they matured as a result of marriage, even if the marriage was awful. Same thing holds for having a child. Also, isn't it the arrogance of these people who write the study? How do you measure happiness? What do? You ask people who have decided to have no children, are you happy? And you ask people who have children, are you happy? And then you make the comparison? The interesting thing, among many other things, about this article and the studies from today, the NBC website, is that's the criterion for making choices. Not is it good, not will you grow, not do you owe it to society. I know this sounds amazing, but one reason to have children and to get married is for the sake of society. That's part of it. My parents got divorced. This is the safety issue. Everything is safe. This last year was eye-opening as to the religion of safetyism. Be safe. When did Americans say that to other Americans, be safe? I'm not sure the astronauts who went to the moon were told, be safe. I'm proud to say I said to nobody once, be safe. I tell people, be well. I wish them health. But I don't wish them, be safe. I equated the whole ethos with narcissism. Why would I get married? And especially, why would I have children? You can't eat out as often. You have to take care of another creature. Oh my God, think about it. Why would I want to do that? So the combination of play it safe and no desire to grow. It turned out child-free people were as satisfied with life as the others. There were no differences in personality traits between the various groups, but child-free adults were significantly more liberal than parents. Now, why might that be?
Coming up, parents take down critical race theory.
How do I have two medical degrees if I'm sitting here oppressed?
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return.
If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, they'll look at a new report at the treatment of Christians in China.
What they're doing is torture, and it's physical torture, mental torture.
And a First Amendment victory for a college professor.
Thankfully, the Sixth Circuit has decided in his favor on the grounds that First Amendment.
Albert Mohler looks at the collision we're witnessing between religious liberty and the fast-advancing agenda of the left.
It's the willingness to say it out loud that's going to get us in trouble.
And Jerry Boyer with a lesson on big tech and the social media companies.
If the service you're using is free, then you're not the customer. You're the product.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. School districts had been implementing variations of critical race theory in their curricula with little pushback until the concept started getting exposure from conservative media. Now parents are showing up to school board meetings and fighting back. Ty Smith was one of those, a conservative radio host who was in the clip as we went to the break. He spoke to Dan Prof and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer out of Chicago. They begin by discussing the video of the clip that went viral after he addressed the Bloomington School Board in Illinois.
Once the video went viral, they actually canceled the next three school board meetings.
Oh, of course.
We won't actually be meeting again until possibly when school is actually starting in August.
Are you kidding? They're that afraid of you?
I think they're afraid of actually what it caused. I think they're afraid of the fact that a lot of parents actually stood up. We've been seeing across the country videos and different segments of people, parents coming right to the school board meetings already, say, we don't want this in our schools. They all of a sudden are saying, well, it's not being taught yet. We're not teaching it yet. Oh, no, don't even try it. The fact that you were even trying to implement it, you know what I mean? The fact that you guys are even thinking about it or even it, to put it into the schools. If you sit there and teach kids about this whole theory and make them believe and think that because of their skin color, this is the reason why they're possibly where they're at, then these kids would actually go out and they're implement those behaviors, not knowing, you know, they don't even know what a theory means. They're going to take it all in as if it's factual.
So you have, I'm going from memory here from your remarks. You have two boys in the school district in question?
One of my sons is not, but my other son, he's 17 years old. He's going to be attending that very school.
What has his experience been like?
They're actually, because of how my sons were raised, there really is no conversation on that because they don't see that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. My sons never had a conversation in my house about color. There was no reason to. You know what I mean? There was no reason to talk about white people or Asian people or black people. There was just no reason to. So my sons grew up their whole entire life just seeing other people as people. I never had to teach them about people. They know that, hey, as far as my house goes, we treat everybody right. But that was not a talk of, hey, we treat white people right. I never had to discuss that. So that's why it's so crazy to me, because the way I raised them is just that, we treat everybody with respect. We love everybody. We treat everybody like we want to be treated. But there was no way I didn't have to sit there and differentiate between what type of people you treat this way. It was just all people, including their teachers, including people at church, whatever. So as they grew up, they're sitting there looking confused, like, why do they want to focus on people's color or anything like that? They're confused, like, what's the reasoning? What? Why?
For the rest of that conversation between Prof. Jacobson and Ty Smith, go to townhallreview.com. Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. May you and yours have a happy 4th of July weekend. Fly your flag, take time with your family and friends to celebrate the freedoms we cherish. Patriotism remains a core American value. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richard, David Bouchon, Harley Eide, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Alex Perez, and of course, Dwayne Patterson and Ben Brigman. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.